This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 29th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Hurricane Sandy hits the Mid-Atlantic and East Coast with rain and strong winds, disrupting transportation, prompting evacuations, and forcing millions of residents to deal with loss of power and flooding. The Supreme Court hears the case of Clapper versus Amnesty International on whether plaintiffs have the right to sue the federal government to challenge broad surveillance powers. And we'll go to Longmont, Colorado, where a local ballot measure that would ban hydraulic fracturing has drawn record amounts of opposition money from the oil and gas industry. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. As millions of people along the northeastern U.S. coast prepare for Hurricane Sandy to make landfall tonight, hundreds of thousands in Haiti, Jamaica, and Cuba are still reeling. All told, at least 65 people died. In Haiti, survivors are shoveling mud from those shacks still standing. Flash floods and major mudslides continue, made worse by widespread deforestation. Almost 400,000 people still live in tent cities in and around hard-hit Port-au-Prince. In Cuba, nearly 150,000 homes were damaged, almost 20,000 totally destroyed or missing roofs, according to the Havana Times. Local elections, scheduled for yesterday, were postponed. As the storm makes its way toward the U.S., parts of New Haven, Connecticut are among many areas along the East Coast that are being evacuated. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
The East Shore neighborhood of New Haven on Long Island Sound was part of a mandatory evacuation order affecting 250,000 residents along the entire state shoreline. The New Haven fire chief said today that his men would rescue anyone in need who had refused to evacuate. But his colleague from East Haven, which suffered a direct hit from Tropical Storm Irene last year, chimed in.
Please don't put us in the position where we have to make a decision like that. It happens. And firemen are made to do that kind of stuff, but I really don't want to send my guys in. They have families, too.
A number of locals interviewed last night said they intended to ride out the storm, but Anna Gaudio had just relocated to her best friend's house a few miles farther from the water. She agrees with climate scientists who have predicted for years that powerful and unusual storms like this one should be expected more often as ocean waters warm and climate change accelerates.
As far as the storm is concerned, you know, I believe this is a result of global warming. It's a product of how we have lived, and we are ruining our world, and this is a product of it.
Governor Daniel Malloy ordered all but emergency vehicles off interstate highways by 1 p.m. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
We'll have much more on the megastorm later in the newscast. Stay tuned. Violence in Syria continued today, the final day of a failed four-day UN-brokered ceasefire in observance of the Muslim Eid al-Adha holiday. Airstrikes, street fights, and a car bomb were reported in Damascus, women and children among the dead. And in Idlib, video reportedly shot today shows a young boy, perhaps 8 years old, completely buried in rubble. At first, not even his head is visible. Then passers-by, frantically removing debris, free his face, then his shoulders, and slowly his torso is pulled from what could have become his grave. An independent journalist from Lebanon is still missing in Syria today. Fida Itani was kidnapped Saturday. A rebel militia called Azaz Northern Storm Brigade claimed responsibility, saying that Itani is being held in Aleppo, quote, because his work was not compatible with the course of the Syrian revolution and revolutionaries. The leader of the Syrian National Council has condemned the kidnapping. 10 people are dead after a suicide bombing in a northern Nigerian church and reprisal attacks on Muslims. About 100 others are injured. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The attack on the Catholic Church and the subsequent reprisal attacks on Muslims came at a time when both groups are working towards peace in Kaduna, a city that has seen lots of sectarian violence. Only 2 days earlier, Christians and Muslims came together for joint celebrations of last weekend's Muslim festival. The latest outbreak of violence is seen as a setback to initiatives to contain the tension in Kaduna and other parts of northern Nigeria. The Islamist sect Boko Haram, whose bombings and killings have claimed hundreds of lives this year in northern Nigeria, is believed to be responsible for the attack on the church. The group is fighting for the introduction of Islamic law in Nigeria and has vowed to scuttle any attempt made by Christians and Muslims to work towards peace. The Islamist sect says both religious groups cannot coexist. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Ongoing demonstrations against a chemical plant in eastern China continued today, even after an announcement yesterday that the project would be stopped. Ningbo city officials say the planned expansion of a plant owned by petrochemical giant Sinopec is now off, but locals fear it's just a delay tactic and remain concerned. Residents in Ningbo are particularly concerned about the production of the toxic chemical paraxylene, or PX, used to manufacture polyester, cleaning supplies, and plastic bottles. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doran Marina in Los Angeles. Millions of residents along the East Coast prepared for the arrival of Hurricane Sandy as strong winds, rain, snow, and some flooding hit regions ahead of the projected landfall this evening. The National Hurricane Center said tropical storm winds had reached Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. The center warned of storm surges along the coast from 6 to 11 feet, 6 to 12 inches of rain with the possibility of inland flooding, and 2 to 3 feet of snow in West Virginia and other areas in the Appalachia region, with harsh weather reaching as far west as Ohio. President Barack Obama said state and local government officials have already started coordinating with FEMA and that search and rescue teams are in place.
We anticipate that the center of the storm is going to hit landfall sometime this evening. But because of the nature of this storm, we are certain that this is going to be a slow-moving process through a wide swath of the country, and millions of people are going to be affected.
Photos posted online showed extensive damage to Atlantic City's boardwalk in New Jersey and parts of Maryland. In New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg ordered the evacuations of more than 370,000 people in Lower Manhattan, Brooklyn, and other low-lying areas. Residents in Red Hook, Brooklyn reported flooding hitting streets this morning. For more, we're joined by Raymond Normando. He's a resident at Queensbridge Houses. That's the largest public housing development in New York. His home lies on the border of the mandatory evacuation zone near to the East River. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
Start with what your neighborhood looks like now. What are the conditions? Is there any flooding at this point?
There's no flooding where I'm looking out the window. However, we are one block away from the East River. I was seriously thinking of putting on a hard hat, my wife and myself, and going over to the park to see if the water is coming to the park at the present time, because with a 10-foot to 12-foot surge, it definitely would cover the park, would come into our basement, and all electricity would be turned off. That means no heat, no electricity, no elevator, and I don't know what else would happen. People might be afraid to leave if water's lapping at the base of the building.
Well, if that is the case, if that's a possibility, what kind of preparations have you been going through to ensure that you're safe?
Ourselves, we're going to be putting down the window shade at night and closing Venetian blinds on top of that. So if a window is broken, it will lessen the impact. We have a 5-gallon jug of water that we've actually had for years. We hope the PCBs have not leached into the water too much. That would be for drinking, and we'll half fill the bathtub with water so that can be used to wash hands and to flush a toilet. We have plenty of food, pre-cooked, in other words, canned food.
Has anybody in your area been evacuated, or are people staying put?
No. However, within walking distance from our building is Zone A, where there was mandatory evacuation yesterday. So our section of Queensbridge Houses, which is the westerly third, would be affected first because that's where the hill starts.
What about your neighbors, the elderly, people with disabilities? Are they getting the services they need?
Well, the one good thing about the New York City Housing Authority, they keep a record of who is on a respirator. So if there was an electricity outage, hopefully they'd get to them very quickly. But I do not know if any of the tenant leaders have been given a list of such people by management. I think it would be strictly up to the housing authority officials to get to those people with respirators. I just see, by the way, that the trees swaying a bit more now.
So maybe the wind is picking up a bit.
Yeah.
New York has closed the subway system. What about buses or other forms of transportation for people in your area?
Well, the water taxis, which comes up and down the East River, that was suspended yesterday. Our subway that comes to Queensbridge Houses, actually this station is Queensbridge 21st Street, that goes under the East River. And if there was flooding, well, the tunnel definitely would get it. And the Roosevelt Island's a bit lower than we are, and there's an entrance on Roosevelt Island for the subway. So if the storm surge covered Roosevelt Island, that would get right into the subway for the F train.
Mr. Normando, how long have you been living there at Queensbridge Houses?
I've been living here with my wife since 1973.
And in your memory, has there been a storm of this magnitude?
No. The previous hurricane, we had seen that they had put sandbags on the subway gratings, sandbags around the elevator going down to the subway. We have not gone outside yet. I don't know whether or not we will. I might have to prod my wife to put on a hard hat with me. Because there's a lot of trees around this area, Queensbridge Park across the street from us. You have to be careful of falling trees, so I would not go in there without a hard hat.
Raymond Normando is a resident at Queensbridge Houses in New York. Mr. Normando, thank you for joining us, and please take care.
Thank you for your concern.
The federal government shut down in Washington, D.C. because of Monday's arrival of Hurricane Sandy. But the U.S. Supreme Court went forward with business as usual. The High Court heard arguments today in a case that pits government national security claims against the privacy rights of journalists and human rights workers who say their communications with associates abroad were monitored without a warrant. The case of Clapper versus Amnesty International doesn't get into the constitutionality of the government's surveillance powers, but focuses on whether the plaintiffs, or anyone, has the right to sue. FSRN's Alice Olstein was at this morning's hearing and files this report.
As the wind and rain of Hurricane Sandy battered the Supreme Court, U.S. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli told the justices that Amnesty International and their co-plaintiffs have no standing to challenge the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments. That law, also known as FISA, gives companies retroactive immunity for helping the government illegally spy on Americans. It also broadens the government's powers to be able to wiretap someone, or a category of people, without proving probable cause. After the Second Circuit Court ruled last year that the lawyers, reporters, and human rights advocates challenging FISA do have standing to sue, National Security Director James Clapper appealed the case to the Supreme Court, asking them to throw out the lawsuit. Jamil Jaffer with the American Civil Liberties Union told the justices Monday that FISA has forced the plaintiffs to censor their phone calls and email conversations with clients overseas and travel to other countries to ensure their talks won't be heard.
I mean, there's no way you can do this kind of work without taking the kinds of measures that they're taking. And it would be irresponsible not to take these measures. It's not just that it's reasonable to do so, but you'd be acting irresponsibly by not taking measures like this.
Jaffer cited affidavits by reporters Naomi Klein and Chris Hedges, saying their sources abroad were now afraid to talk to them. Justice Elena Kagan seemed to agree they were legitimately injured and had standing to sue, saying that, quote, information is the lifeblood of journalism, and the FISA statute has caused it to dry up. The justices also asked repeatedly about the harm to lawyers, who may have to censor their communications to protect their clients. Attorney Shane Cottadall with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who submitted an amicus brief for this case, said he's experienced this firsthand.
There are people who simply no longer want to communicate with us because they know the risk of surveillance is so much greater than it used to be. And that, combined with the costs that we have to incur just to, you know, engage in the regular communications we have to litigate our cases, it makes it that much harder to challenge all the other illegal behavior of this administration and the last administration as well.
Cottadall, whose organization represents Guantanamo detainees and other individuals targeted by the U.S. government, said he appreciated the justice's questions on who could be monitored under FISA's spying powers.
There were a lot of questions about, you know, isn't it true that people don't have to even be terrorism suspects? And that's absolutely true. Innocent third parties who are witnesses to human rights violations overseas may be scared to talk to American lawyers because they may worry that our government may intercept it and then may share it with their government, right? Journalists in other countries who aren't terrorism suspects, obviously, they may have information we want to, you know, sort of get from them to use in our cases, but they may very well be unwilling to talk to us now because the scope of surveillance under this statute is so great.
The government said the court should throw out the group's challenge to the FISA amendments because they can't prove they have been or will be spied on. Verrilli also argued that striking down FISA wouldn't remedy their concerns, since the government has many other methods of surveillance it could use. But Jaffer says winning the standing to sue through this case is a crucial first step towards challenging other government violations of privacy.
The consequence of accepting the government's argument is to insulate the statute from any meaningful kind of judicial review. It's hard to see how this kind of statute is ever going to be reviewed if plaintiffs like ours don't have standing.
The House of Representatives voted in September to renew the FISA amendments for 5 years. And the Senate has to do the same before current law expires in December. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney have been battling hard for support in Florida, where early voting has begun. The state's 29 electoral votes could prove crucial to a win in the tight presidential race. But in Florida, there are 10 other presidential candidates on the ballot, not counting write-ins. One of them is PETA Lindsey, candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Lindsey has been a community organizer with the Philadelphia Student Union and with the Anti-War Answer Coalition. WMNF's Sean Canan sat down with her to discuss her candidacy and the issues most important to her party. Lindsey began by describing the background for the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
We are a nationwide party, a party primarily made up of activists and organizers. From our perspective, real change doesn't come from the politicians. Real change comes from the people, from the organized movement of masses of people. So we're very concerned with building the struggle.
So what made you decide to run for president?
Well, like I said, we're primarily a party of activists and organizers, and we believe in building the movement. But when, you know, the elections come around, it's like the biggest propaganda apparatus in the history of the world, telling people to vote, 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 that like real change comes to the ballot box, basically telling people to demobilize, to go back inside and wait for the politicians to do it for them. And so during that time, you know, well, we want to keep fighting for the things the working people want. So we can't sit on the sidelines during the elections. We have to get in there, too. Like if that's where everyone's focused, if that's where all the media attention, all the people are looking to, then we're going to get into that race as well. So we got into this race, you know, with a 10-point program that we think speaks to the things that working people need. You know, we're talking about free education, free healthcare, affordable housing. You know, we're talking about making a job a constitutional right. We're talking about ending the wars. You know, so we think that it's one more way to fight for these things and to mobilize people and get them to, you know, the people who are struggling and get them to fight in their own communities for these things.
In this election, we've heard a lot about socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear people who are critical of President Obama saying that he's a socialist. What are your thoughts about what socialism means and how that applies to President Obama?
Yeah, well, very simply, for us, socialism means, you know, this is an extraordinarily wealthy country, and we believe that the wealth of this country was created by working people, and we believe that wealth should go to providing the things that working people need. We're talking about reorganizing society so that the rights of people, the needs of the people come first, and profit isn't concerned at all. You know, right now we have a society that's entirely organized for profit based on what's profitable, you know, what's going to get greater and greater amounts of wealth into smaller and smaller numbers of people, while the majority of us, the vast majority of working people in this country, are plunged into deeper and deeper misery. So we're against all that. You know, we're saying, let's reorganize society, let's have more equality, and let's you know, let's use all this tremendous wealth to fund the things that we need, fund things like healthcare, housing, education, jobs. We believe all of these things should be fundamental constitutional rights. That whole question of whether or not Obama's a socialist, it's so ludicrous. You know, name one socialist thing Obama's done. Obama presided over the largest transfer of public funds into private hands in our nation's history. You know, he gave $700 billion of our money, of tax money, to the big banks, you know, to the big banks overnight. And, you know, gave it to them, no strings attached. They have yet to account for what they did with the money. But, you know, that's the opposite of socialism. That's the opposite of what we're talking about and what a socialist would do. You know, we actually want to take that ill-gotten money, you know, that these massive profits that have been ripped out of people's hands, you know, forcing people out of their homes. We want to take that money from the banks and use that money to fund a jobs program, to use that money to build housing, use that money to make sure that everyone can go to the doctor when they're sick.
One of the things that your party is concerned about is militarism.
Mm-hmm.
How does that play out at the national level as far as budgets and as far as priorities for the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really excellent point. And, you know, I think we believe that the U.S. government is, in fact, the biggest threat to peace in the world right now. We're calling for the immediate end of all the wars, and we're calling for bringing all the troops home and closing down all of the bases. The war in Afghanistan costs close to $400 million a day. I mean, think about what we could do with that money. You know, I was an activist for Philadelphia Public Schools when I was a student in Philadelphia. And this year they announced that the Philadelphia Public Schools have a budget shortfall of, I believe it was $278 million. And so they're being forced to privatize the school system is what they say. So one day of the war in Afghanistan, one day of that $400 million could fix the crisis in Philadelphia and then some. Like, imagine what we could do with this tremendous amount of money. So the real spending for the Pentagon is something like $1 trillion. And we're saying, shut it down. Let's take that money. And instead of using it to slaughter our sisters and brothers abroad, you know, instead of using it to slaughter people in Afghanistan, people in Libya, people who just want to go to work, want to take care of their families, want the same things that we do, let's use that money to invest in our communities, to invest in, you know, in working people in the U.S.
And finally, I want to ask you about ballot access. You're on the ballot in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
What other states are you on the ballot in, and how hard was it to get on the ballot in those states?
That's a great question. It's extremely hard to get on the ballot. You know, they say anybody can run for president until you actually try to do it and you realize how hard it is. It's such an undemocratic set of laws, and it varies from state to state, which doesn't make any sense. You know, for a federal office, there should be one set of rules, right? Like for one federal office for, you know, for people to qualify. We don't know of any other country in the world that operates like the U.S. where, like, for this one office, they have completely different qualifications from state to state. And for, in some states, it's extremely difficult. And we know that that's, you know, that's intentional. They want to keep out opposing voices. They want to keep out anyone who's not one of the big corporate candidates. You know, like, I believe Romney and Obama are spending like $2.5 billion this year. And though they're both wealthy individually, you don't get that kind of money without the big banks and the corporations, right? So we believe that the elections are fundamentally a sham, but we participate in them as a way of building the movement. But when it comes to getting on the ballot, you know, we want to show people we're serious, that we mean what we're doing. So we've been on the we're on the ballot in 13 states. And we've done it with no money, you know, like not even millions, not even billions. We've done it with very little money, but with a great organization of volunteers who really believe in what we're doing. You know, we turned in something like 30,000 signatures to get on the ballot in New York City. And this really, these are people who volunteered. Not a single person was paid. You know, we were just doing this because we believe in it and because we believe in, you know, in a revolution and a new system and, you know, in getting our voice out through this election.
That's presidential candidate PETA Lindsay of the Party for Socialism and Liberation speaking with WMNF's Sean Canan. Voters in Longmont, Colorado will decide whether or not to ban hydraulic fracturing within city limits. The oil and gas industry has poured record amounts of money into a campaign to defeat the citizens-led ballot measure. FSRN's Maeve Conran has the story.
The city of just over 80,000 people north of Denver has been at the heart of a debate over fracking regulations in the state. Last December, the city council imposed a moratorium on new drilling permits while they updated regulations. The new regulations included voluntary standards on noise and lighting and voluntary setbacks from schools, parks and homes. But in July, when they were to go into effect, the Office of the Colorado Attorney General filed a lawsuit against the city. The suit states that Longmont is stepping on the state's authority to regulate the industry.
Much of what's in the city's regulations is essentially voluntary. The citizens aren't protected.
That's Kay Fissinger. She's the campaign manager for Question 300, which would place in the city's charter a ban on oil and gas drilling, essentially outlawing the practice of hydraulic fracturing within city limits. She says an amendment to the city charter is necessary because the current city regulations don't go far enough. And she says the existing state regulations are woefully inadequate.
This is the message that we are trying to send. We as citizens, wherever we are in Colorado, but particularly here in Longmont, which is our issue, are entitled to be protected. And we are not being protected.
This citizen-led initiative has drawn the attention of the oil and gas industry, which has poured nearly $500,000 into a campaign to defeat Measure 300.
It's an important public policy issue for the oil and gas industry in Colorado.
Bill Ray is the spokesperson for the campaign to defeat ballot issue 300.
If Initiative 300 goes into effect, it's not just the state that will have standing to sue the city of Longmont. You would have anyone who is a royalty holder or a mineral rights holder, a surface rights holder who might want to see oil and gas production on their property, they would have a right to sue the city of Longmont because the city of Longmont took away, by the passage of 300, that ability, that right to have that oil and gas mineral explored. So 300 opens the city to many, many more lawsuits from many more entities.
But Yes on 300 campaign manager Kay Fissinger says any discussion about future lawsuits is speculation and part of a scare tactic campaign.
You're trying to make people vote their pocketbook instead of the health and safety of their themselves and of their families. I mean, people have little kids, and older people have grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's what they need to be thinking about. What is it going to do to their development? It should not be a pocketbook issue for people. It needs to be a health and safety issue.
If the fracking ban passes, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper has indicated that he would support more litigation against Longmont. The governor was met with an angry crowd of protesters in Longmont at a recent invitation-only panel discussion on the fracking regulations.
We get sick and you don't care. Poison water, poison air.
The Democrat formerly worked as a geologist for an oil company and has been criticised by environmental groups in the state for his support of the oil and gas industry. Speaking in September, he said he'd hoped the state and the city would find common ground.
Well, we're obviously very disappointed that we couldn't find that compromise, and I think we still might, right? Not everything that goes to court gets settled by a judge. Oftentimes there are compromises there.
But a compromise seems unlikely, and other Colorado cities are closely watching the outcome of Question 300 as they attempt to regulate oil and gas activity in their own communities. Although the campaign to ban fracking has only raised about $20,000, much less than the industry-backed opponents, Kay Fissinger says they're not intimidated.
Oh, absolutely. It's David and Goliath. This didn't come as a surprise to us. We knew that they were going to throw this kind of money at us. $500,000 so far. And it's all from 28 oil and gas companies and their various industry associations. Not a single solitary person from Longmont has contributed to the No on 300 campaign, whereas the Yes on 300 campaign has several hundred contributors, individual contributors.
There is no court date established yet for the state-led lawsuit, but if voters approve the fracking ban on November 6th, that court date could be just the first in a long battle between Longmont citizens and the oil and gas industry. Maeve Conran, FSRN, Longmont, Colorado.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.